Coming up today, Facebook is trying to combat online bullying. A bone belonging to the world's biggest dinosaur has been discovered, and New York is trying to ban face scrubs for being an environmental hazard. We'll also be discussing locally grown lab meat and espionage in a post-privacy era. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to titanosaurs and regrowing faces. I'm your host, Olivia underscore Solon, and I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
I hesitated a little bit because I was looking at the notes and I was about to read out that I was Nate Langson, but that would be incorrect.
And that you are the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm neither the editor of Wired.co.uk nor am I Nate Langson, so sorry for that. But Katie, welcome back. You've just come back from the Netherlands.
Thank you. I think I said that right. Yes, I have. I've been over in the Netherlands at a really cool conference called PINK, which is all about its kind of culture and technology and science, politics, everything in between, and just people that have got a really interesting story. So I'll be telling you a little bit more about that later.
Excellent. Leah, you're about to head off, so you're in a bit of a rush today.
I am, yes. To Francais. Speed it up, girl.
To French.
Yeah, to French. I don't speak French.
It's just France.
I might have
France
a bit of
and French
problem.
Is just France.
Shut up.
Okay, well, I think we're digressing slightly already, so we're going to get cracking with the news. Liat, you're going to tell me about how Facebook is trying to combat online bullying.
Yes, it's going to train your kiddies. And us, I guess. If you bullied me, Liv, I've got some tools that I can now equip myself with.
Okay.
Courtesy of Facebook. So they've basically relaunched their reporting system, the tools that you use when someone posts an annoying or offensive photo and you want to complain about it, as I did earlier, actually, about one of Liv's pictures. And they've also published a UK bullying prevention centre as part of this. Now, this is kind of part of a wider push from Facebook, who basically claims they're leading the way in this area. They've had a huge amount of criticism from people saying they're not doing enough to prevent children from being bullied and, you know, various problems of that nature. This came to a head earlier this year when there was an inquest into the suicide of a teenager who was using Tumblr to learn about self-harm and suicide and was being bullied as well. And I went to a conference where they were basically ministers arguing there should be legislation, and Facebook was there saying no education. And now it has kind of delivered on that promise. It's rolling out this week in the UK and across Europe, having already been launched in the US at the end of last year. And it's part of a big research project. They've had experts from Yale and Berkeley in kind of conflict resolution and teen bullying, and have really looked into kind of the nuances of language and how best to approach this and how to encourage children and teenagers to actually use these tools properly and not, you know, not be too afraid to kind of approach somebody.
Yeah, there's some really interesting kind of insights that were drawn out of the research that, you know, perhaps the most people wouldn't think would make a difference to whether you report something or not, but actually made an enormous difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of across the board, what they found was make language more colloquial, less serious, kind of lighter. You know, some of the things you can say are quite heavy, and people were clicking on hate speech because it was one of the few options they had, rather than describing, you know, they had no option to describe it more. So what happened originally was you would be able to report something, and Facebook would ask you, how do you feel about this? And they gave one a word adjective answers like embarrassed, upset, sad. What they found was that 50% of people were actually typing into the other box, it's embarrassing, it's making me upset because of this, whatever. They were personalizing it and they wanted to expand more. So as soon as they made that tiny change and put it's embarrassing to the flow of the reporting system, Facebook found that Facebook found that engagement with the reporting system went up 78% from this specific step when yes. reporting a photo.
So all they did was, the phrasing was something like, instead of saying, what do you think about this picture? I feel embarrassed. It says, this picture makes me feel...
Exactly. It's embarrassing. Right? How do you feel about this picture? It's embarrassing. Or it just makes it a bit kind of lighter and colloquial. One that was perhaps more obvious was using polite terms. So when you go through the reporting system, you can select an option to send a message to whoever has posted the content that you don't like. And the automated message used to be very, very blunt, basically take this down. They'd get a very impersonal message. And Facebook changed it to, hey, Olivia, so, we get you in there, so that you would be more open to it, and then would use terms like please and I would prefer. And these performed like markedly better than the alternatives they tried. And previously, only 20% of people using the reporting system would actually choose to send a message. Now it's 60% of people. Overall, what they really found was, they're trying to translate real world scenarios to the digital world, and it's about putting as much emotion as possible into the language. Because generally, if you know that, if it's a friend and it's just something they might not have realized would upset you, they would care.
Yeah,
if they upset
like
you,
like an embarrassing photo of you at a hen do, for example.
Exactly.
But even interesting, even things like the word report that used to be such a feature, report this image. Didn't they even change that for the age group for teenagers so that it was, I don't like this picture?
Yeah, which is, in fact, they've changed that for everyone now. I just tried it earlier and it just says, I don't like this picture, which is a really obvious thing if you think about it, because if you don't like something, what you don't want is your friend or colleague or friend of a friend to get a message saying, you have been reported by Liat Clark, and they found that teenagers were really worried about getting their friends in trouble, so they just weren't clicking on it at all. So now it's really open. If you click on it, it just says, I don't like this picture, which is, something probably a lot of people would click on. And then it takes you through these steps. So it's kind of, it's engaging you in a dialogue, and then it encourages you as much as possible to then take that dialogue to your friend or foe. I mean, depending, if it's serious bullying or seriously inappropriate content, they will obviously be reviewing it as they do any other scenario.
This seems like a really, really like grown up approach to the problem. I know that there's been so much stuff about Twitter not adding reporting buttons quick enough when there's been all this harassment. But it does seem that Facebook makes a lot of effort in this space. And I know that everyone is named on Facebook, at least, most people have their proper name on it. So it is a slightly different environment, but to have it, getting people to actually talk to each other and resolve it in the way that they might do offline in an online world seems to be a much better solution.
Absolutely. And I think Facebook obviously are massive. They have the resources to do this kind of research and make sure they do it right. And so many kids use it and put so much personal information on it that it's clear that you need to educate kids not just about coding and other digital literacy. They need to know kind of life skills for dealing with things like privacy online, which they're not really teaching. And this is a really great way of kind of implementing part of that into the most used network in the world.
The second story we're going to discuss this week is the fact that paleontologists in Argentina have found an enormous fossilised thigh bone, which they think belongs to the world's biggest dinosaur. Now, the bone looks pretty much like a large tree trunk. It's about 1.5 times the length of a man. And it suggests that the animal was 40 metres in length and 20 metres tall. That's about 14 times the size of an African elephant, or twice the size of a big lorry. And the paleontologists believe that it's a new species of titanosaur. They've estimated that it weighs 77 tonnes, or at least it would have weighed when it was alive. That's about 7 tonnes heavier than the next largest dinosaur, which is called the Argentinosaurus. And this does sound quite badass. You imagine it to be this, giant, monstrous Godzilla of a creature.
Sounds a bit scary.
Yeah, but they were actually herbivores from the Cretaceous period. So
what?
As long as you sort of stay out of its way and don't get underfoot, then you're probably fine. Is
yeah,
that right?
Or don't disguise yourself as any kind of shrubbery that it might
imagine what they had to eat. How many trees a day?
And how many poos? How much poos?
Gosh.
But yeah, this bone and about 150 others were found. They were first discovered by a farmer in the Patagonian desert. And it's believed that there are around seven different animals that have had died in the same area. And they thought that they might have become stuck in the mud during a drought as they were kind of tried to find water to drink. But the bones also featured the remains of carnivorous teeth, about 60 teeth that seemed to have broken off as other scavengers tried to munch on the bodies of these giant, big friendly giants. They might not have been friendly. They might have been big surly giants. We don't know, do we? But so far, it doesn't have a name. And I think this is kind of the cool thing. It's up for grabs at the moment. Obviously, Argentinosaurus has been taken. And following that naming convention, so too has Patagosaurus. But I like Clashosaurus, as in Clash of the Titans.
That's a beautiful name.
Yeah, yeah. I think something that demonstrates quite how big and, you know, mammoth this was. Although, obviously,
mammoth is taken also as well. Taken.
But I think it has to be like the big friendly giant is big, but it's nice.
Maybe the BFG would be. I don't think that's officially been taken by any creature.
Not yet. I'd like to know what you want to call the dinosaur. Tell us at podcast@wired.co.uk. And there's an amazing picture on the website. If you want to see how big this bone is, go and check it out. Just look for titanosaur on wired.co.uk. Katie, if my face gets eaten off by my puppy, will I be able to grow a new one?
Well, not yet, but maybe eventually. So, did you know that 28 successful face transplants have now taken place over the course of the last few years worldwide?
I knew there was a chimpanzee that ripped that woman's face off, and there was also that other woman who passed out and her dog, when she was smoking a cigarette, and her dog chewed half her face off and she had it replaced as well, French woman.
So they're getting way better at this, and now actually in America, if you lose a hand and you're eligible, a hand transplant is standard practice. Which suggests that if you are going to lose a hand, then maybe try and do it in America. Not that you tend to have much control over that kind of thing.
No.
But we've successfully learned how to do hand and face transplants, and they've been going really well. But there are two downsides, especially when it comes to faces. So firstly, there are a lack of people willing to donate their face in the first place after they've died, which perhaps isn't that surprising.
I think that's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a little bit like people not being keen on donating parts of their eyes.
Brains.
But in the UK now, isn't it all default? So actually we probably have, or are they calling for it to be default?
They're calling for it to be default. I wrote about brain donations a while ago because it's a massive problem that there aren't enough donors for brains. Anyway, I think we're digressing a bit.
And secondly, people who have had the transplant operation have to then be on immunosuppressants for life, because skin, unlike other organs, which sometimes reject your body, skin strongly rejects other people's skin that has been transplanted onto you. So the doctor who first worked on face transplants and developed the technique is now trying to develop a new technique which will actually help people regrow and regenerate the tissue, which would reduce the need to do face transplants anyway.
But he actually thinks we can regrow our hands.
Yes, so as with face transplants, he's working on doing hand transplants first.
So how on earth is he doing this?
So he believes that this can happen, and it is possible because it happens in nature all the time, and he points to a number of different animals, including frogs, salamanders, and even deer, which obviously regrow their horns every year.
But isn't that more like growing our nails than growing our hands?
No, it's not quite the same. Even humans, actually, I didn't know this, but even humans can regenerate their fingertips before a certain age. So I think it's before you're 8. If you lose the tip of your finger, you can regenerate it, as we found. So the idea is that if we grew our hand in the first place, by logic, our genome knows how to do this. This information is stored within us somewhere. So if he can learn how to turn that part of the genome back on, he believes there's no reason that we couldn't actually regrow a hand, because our bodies have done it before. They know how to do it. So what he's doing is he's comparing the genomes of humans, mice and salamanders to try and look at the differences between them and see where the part of the genome might be that is responsible for this. So far, they've managed to regenerate bone stem cells by putting them in a scaffold and getting the bone to grow. So this is basically looking at the, I think it's called the blastema, where all the kind of information is stored about the kind of mother cells that initially grew your hands and face and all the rest of it. And they've discovered in mice, actually, by running electrical pulses through stem cells in the blastema, they have been able to, they can make the cells move and they can actually generate some regrowth. So this is still at quite an early stage, but it's actually looking quite promising. And it sounds crazy. It sounds like science fiction, but this could mean it could make so much difference to people who have suffered injuries, and he is really dedicated to kind of pursuing this, and fingers crossed that it's not that far off.
Immense. So does he think you can do legs and everything?
I don't know. He's just focusing. His main interest is the face. So he's, and the hand is the gateway to the face in this case.
I think that's very interesting. I don't know why. All the bones and tendons, and it's odd.
But in my mind, and this is completely wrong, I'm sure, but I've just got this image of growing back a hand, but it growing the size as it was when you were in the womb.
Oh,
don't. So you just have this tiny little hand that maybe would grow. I don't know. I mean, I really need someone to write about this.
Yeah, how would it know to, you know, for the bones
but
to
imagine,
stop?
I imagine
right
it wouldn't
point.
Be like growing a hand in the same way you'd grow a plant. It would be more create a scaffold
controlled,
which where the bone can be grown, the vessels can grow into, and the skin can grow over in the right way, as opposed to being you're going to go back to a little kind of fetus hand that's going to grow somehow.
No.
That would be really creepy. If you're working in this space and you think this is a bit too ridiculous, please do talk to us. Email us on podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, the last piece of news for this week is about microbeads. Now, if you've ever used a face or body scrubbing product, it's very likely to have contained plastic microbeads, tiny little spheres. And these are what give these products their abrasive properties. And it's pretty much in any face wash or body wash brand that has any sort of abrasive properties. So Clearasil, Clean and Clear, L'Oreal, Neutrogena. Now, the problem is that these tiny little beads are generally smaller than 1 millimeter across, and they go down the drain, and they often pass through water treatment facilities, which means they end up in the water supply. And like other plastic, they are pollutant.
So every time you wash your face, you're making the world a worse place.
Yeah. Well, I think, yes, you are. In some ways, a slightly better place because you've got a clean face, but you are also
just
making
soap.
I didn't realise the scale of this problem. In fact, I didn't know this was a problem at all. But a study estimates that almost 19 tonnes of these microbeads are discharged into wastewater in the state of New York alone. And for that reason, the state is trying to ban them. Now, this is because these little beads act as sponges for toxic chemicals. And then they obviously get into the water stream, and then fish and other creatures mistake them for food. So the pollutants start to enter the food chain. So fish that humans eat might have it in, birds, turtles and mammals. And this can obviously be very bad. And it's not just the US where there's a problem. It's just the US which is trying to ban them. There was a study done in the North Sea that found that for every 200 ml container of scrub product, 21 grams of microplastics would end up in the sewer system. And another study off the coast of Plymouth found that a third of all fish had traces of plastic in them. And this could then block their digestive systems and kill them. And I think this is really sad.
Yeah, it's awful. London would be really bad as well. I mean, in New York, it's New York State kind of concentration of people. How do we fix this, Liv? What are we going to wash our faces with?
Well, there are loads of alternatives. This is the ridiculous thing. And actually, alternatives were used widely until about the mid-90s. Things like ground almonds, oatmeal and peach kernels were used. And then these microbeads became popularised in the mid-90s. A number of the big personal care companies, including Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Colgate, Palmolive and L'Oreal, have all said that they are kind of going to remove plastic from their products. But as far as I can tell, they haven't done it over here yet.
It makes me wonder how long they've actually known about this, and whether this is something that they've been aware of for a while but have just been keeping quiet about.
Well, they definitely pledged to do this about 2 years ago, but wow, I'm still seeing a lot of these products on the shelves when in the supermarket.
I kind of can't believe it's taken this long. If you think about it, I'm Unilever, and I decided one day to put in my soluble, you know, soaps, little plastic balls. The fact that it kind of got through all the regulations in the first place, and we've only just figured out that it's probably not that great to have loads of plastic balls floating around, seems ridiculous. It does. And also, I just, you know, like, let's just say it, microbeads are rubbish. They just don't work.
Yeah, I don't use them.
I've used them and they don't work.
I don't really miss them. I, you know, use something organic. Use something nice and organic.
Okay, good.
They don't slough my skin very well.
Is that how you say that word? I was going to put it into my notes, but I didn't know if it was like slough or slough. Having a lot of vocab revelations this week.
Also, I went swimming in the North Sea at the weekend and now I'm a bit worried about why.
Have you now
Did you swallow
microbeads?
It?
Well, who knows?
Well, that's all the news for this week, but still to come, we're going to talk about the future of espionage and locally grown lab meat.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
The first segment for this week's podcast is an old favourite. We're going to ride the Technosaurus. Now, this week's Technosaurus is wearing dark shades and a fake moustache because it's carrying out espionage. Katie?
Yes, so as I said earlier, I attended the Pink Conference in the Netherlands this week. And one of the speakers there was named Richard Aldrich, and he specialises in the history of espionage, which is a really cool thing to specialise in my opinion. And he's just released a book about GCHQ, but what he's now interested in is actually the future of espionage. So he argues that the end of secrecy and the end of privacy are upon us, and suggests that this will affect both us, but it will also affect governments and corporations and how they watch us. So he asks whether in this post-privacy and post-secrecy world, whether there are still some things that need to remain secret. So firstly, our privacy. We're used to the idea that intelligence agencies spy on us these days. We know all about that. But over the last 10 years, the biggest intelligence gatherers have actually become airlines, banks, internet providers, even places like Tesco, all of which have more information about us than GCHQ and the NSA put together. So
I can't believe that.
I know. No. But so he says that by studying everything that he has bought over the last 5 years, these companies have such sophisticated systems now that they could predict with about 90% accuracy how he will vote in the upcoming European elections. Something he claims not even to know himself yet, which is quite worrying.
I'd like to know how he came to that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
But having said that, was that quite famous case where Target, the US retailer, knew that a daughter was pregnant based on her purchasing habits before her father knew, and they sent her some offers for pregnancy related products, and her father went through the roof, called Target, and it turned out that she was in fact pregnant because of some of the things she'd been buying. Not obvious.
But was she buying
like
maternity wear?
No, not even that. It wasn't like she was buying pregnancy tests, because that would obviously be a giveaway, but she was switched to fragrance free products and a few other things. I can't remember.
Yeah, so this is one kind of thing where we're kind of losing our own privacy, but he also claims that citizens too are becoming intelligence gatherers, and he points to the Boston Marathon bombings, which is actually a really interesting example, because what happened in the blogosphere after the bombings were that people were posting pictures online, so they were trying to work out maybe if the bomber had been in their vicinity.
Yeah.
And then more people popped up and said, oh, I recognize this person, I recognize this person, I know where this person lives.
Yeah.
And before he knew it, this poor guy ended up with people like a mob outside his house, basically, because he'd been wrongly identified
and
as
also,
the bomber.
I remember someone's dad, one of the people who were horribly wounded, I think the guy who, there was a very famous picture of him in a wheelchair with his leg shredded. And I think his father saw that first on Facebook. Someone had posted it as a news story before he'd even found out that his son had been involved.
But that happens all the time.
Yeah,
news,
but this is exactly
gathering.
What this is talking about here.
So, I mean, this kind of data, it's not just as if the danger is coming from sort of security agencies or corporations in our own hands. If it's not used correctly, as citizens, we can be just as dangerous as corporations and governments if we use this data in a dangerous way.
I kind of feel like we just shouldn't be allowed to know anything. Doesn't sound like any good is going to come of it.
The thing is, because of technology, we do have access to so much more data. We're all gathering data all the time, whether we mean to and whether we do anything with it or not. So this is kind of also leading to a sacrifice of our own privacy. The more cameras there are around, the more information systems we put our data into, the less control we have over it, and that's kind of just the way it is. But at the same time, corporations and governments are also losing their ability to keep secrets. So 10 years ago, if you wanted to steal the amount of data that Edward Snowden stole from the NSA, you'd need a photocopier and a ton of plastic bags, basically. And all he needed was a flash drive. Aldrich points to one problem, which he says is the kind of the real danger in terms of secrecy and privacy. And he mentions the Stuxnet problem, which is, if you know about the Stuxnet virus, it was basically a virus which we're pretty sure was partly created, at least, by the NSA. And it was used to attack Iranian nuclear facilities. And this was a while ago, so it's back in 2007, 2008 that it was created. It was deployed in 2009. But it was a really, really powerful virus, and it managed to get out onto the internet, and people have kind of got it in labs and are playing with it and all sorts of things now. But what he says is, what if the next Edward Snowden comes from the part of the NSA, not the intelligence gathering part, but the part that's creating viruses? And do we need to still have some security and secrecy when it comes to these things? So what do you guys think?
Well, there must be, surely. Anyway, especially now, post Edward Snowden, the security on those types of things would be massive.
Yeah. This was raised, I remember, when WikiLeaks did a big dump of data. I can't remember what it was. It was before Snowden. But the idea that diplomacy at its heart relies on it relies on slightly unequal information on both sides. So if you're kind of trying to appease two people and they both got very different agendas, you don't just tell them the same thing. You slightly tailor the way you might talk to one country versus another and hope to come to a compromise or an agreement. And by shoving everything out in the open, it can create a kind of jarring feeling. I don't know, it's hard. Secrecy makes it sound a bit too sly. I think there's something less than secrecy that is kind of, it's like white lies versus outward lies.
Yeah.
There are things that need to be handled better than just dumping it out in the open. Having said that, I'm a firm believer in open data. And I think we are increasingly requiring that corporations allow us to download our data and take back control of it. So I'm a bit conflicted.
Yeah. I remember when all the journalists from The Guardian and the New York Times were going through all the data with Edward Snowden and looking at how to publish it and what to publish it. They approached it very, very carefully in terms of they had to editorialize stuff. They had to choose which bits that they were going to publish without damaging certain operations that were ongoing, that the secret intelligence agencies were running. Yeah. So I guess, to a certain extent, even those sort of advocates of publishing all this kind of data are still very, very careful about what actually gets out there.
Yeah. I think the problem is, historically, there have been attempts to stonewall requests for data from government agencies and government departments by just saying it's a matter of national security.
Absolutely.
And then you don't, there's no one checking that it is indeed the case that it's a matter of national security. And often it's just used as an excuse.
Yeah.
And it stems back for many, many years. But I think that's the problem, is no one's holding that process to account. And I think that's what we've been calling for the last year or so.
Yeah. And that has been very much ingrained in the US system in terms of the secret courts and the fact that actually the only people that could go into the secret courts and hear the information are the people that
already know it.
Yes. That is the part of the system we have to break. But that's also basically getting people to trust the public, I guess, and trust that giving away some information is not going to destroy your country. Mm. It's going to make things better.
So I guess in the sort of post-secrecy, post-privacy age, the governments generally need to learn to adapt to the fact that a lot of this information is going to be more out there, and they need to come up with a kind of a process for making sure that the stuff that needs to be protected remains protected.
Mm.
Things like computer viruses that they may be developing for cyber warfare that they don't want to get into the wrong hands, and they really do need to protect.
Yeah.
And the rest of the stuff which they are going to have to be held to account for more in the future.
Yeah. I do think it's a matter of kind of balance. It's like security these days. It's no longer just put up a firewall and protect your infrastructure as carefully as possible. It's about kind of managing risk. So it's much more fluid these days. Things do get out, but how do you minimize that? And perhaps you need to be more open in some places and less open in the other. But I feel like there's so many social and cultural and political situations where some level of secrecy, or at least an imbalance of information, is important, and having none of that makes a lot of things very difficult, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine the conversations you have with your friends if on Facebook, if suddenly the privacy settings were changed so that every single message that you sent, every single chat you'd had, was suddenly made public. Would you be comfortable with that?
Of course not. But is he not talking, when he talks about post-privacy era, is he not talking about the fact that somewhere our information is somewhere, someone can find it? You're comfortable with giving some for an exchange, but surely is he not commenting on the fact that just all our information is accessible? Yeah, because it is all digital.
Yeah, I think he drew a comparison to saying if we did live in a completely transparent society, it would be like suddenly having to go and live in a nudist colony. And that's probably how uncomfortable we would feel.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite, it was probably quite apt.
Yeah, we need some fig leaves of privacy at
least.
Well, what do you think about this topic? Do you feel that we should have more transparency with governments, with social networking sites, with companies, or do you think we need to keep our secrets? Please tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk. The second segment for today is Thank You Science. Well, it's almost Thank You Science. I don't think we're quite there yet, are we, Liat? We're talking about lab-grown meat.
Yeah, we're a ways there, but not very far, if you saw Mark Post's lab meat burger last year.
$250,000, was it?
Pounds, yeah,
pounds.
I believe, to create one burger.
Yeah, I got to see it in the flesh.
And smell it, but you didn't get to taste it.
No.
Did you really get to smell it?
Yes, yeah, you could smell it cooking.
Oh, right.
They cooked
it
in front
from
of
a
us,
distance.
And it did smell like cooked meat.
But it apparently tasted neutral.
Yeah, a bit bland.
A bit, yeah.
The main complaint actually was lack of seasoning.
Oh, well, why on earth didn't they get a good chef? Oh, no.
And also the problem was fat, because of the fat in meat contains a lot of the flavour, and this just didn't have any fat on it.
Absolutely. There's lots of challenges, obviously, before we can get to tasty lab meat. Things like getting oxygen throughout the meat so you can, you know, create a fillet steak one day. You need those blood vessels, and we haven't engineered those. But I spoke to a philosopher and biologist who was basically envisioning a future where we have lab meat factories in every town and village. And this basically, her idea is has been designed to get more people interested in lab meat, because obviously, you know, the problem we have right now is not a lot of people want to eat something grown in a lab from stem cells.
Interested. I mean, we're all interested in lab meat. It's just we don't want to eat it.
Exactly. You might not want to feel
I'd
that.
Eat it.
I mean, yeah. I would try it. But yeah, I mean, after that description, I'm not sure. I spoke with a professor called Cor van der Veel from the Netherlands, who says, yes, you know, insects might be an option to supplement our nutrition as we're looking for more sustainable sources of protein. But, you know, people love meat and they're always going to want meat. So her hypothesis is, how do we actually get people interested in this? Just the same way that people are looking into how we can get more people in the West to eat insects. So she actually held some focus groups after Mark Post delivered, you know, the first lab meat burger to the world to gauge the public's feelings. And she found a few surprising things. Mainly people thought it was a hopeful concept because they have a lot of moral doubts over traditional farming and animal suffering. You know, there's so much more awareness about it today. And sustainability issues apparently did not come up with her focus groups. They didn't really care about that. They cared about animals suffering. So grow them instead, grow bits of them. She also found out that older people were very much on board rather than younger generations, which I thought was interesting. Mm. But this was down to the fact that, you know, they were saying when they were younger, the quality of meat was much better and they didn't eat as much as we do today. You know, a lot of people really do have it with, you know, every dinner. Mm. But the main problem was that people were reluctant. They found it unnatural and too technological. And they feared that these types of issues would further alienate us from our food rather than kind of mend those broken broken fences between us and our meat. So the idea of an urban lab meat farm came up. And the idea is you've got your neighbourhood cow and pig in every village and every town, and you just take its stem cells and you've got, you know, a solid line of stem cells coming from this beast, and you know where your food is coming from, and the lab is adjoined to this kind of little urban farm, so you're not, you know, it's not so far removed factory,
locally sourced frankenfood.
Yeah. It's very good.
I quite like the idea. I think I do too.
I really do.
And to have the living creature there that, while you're eating
exactly. It's funny actually that someone brought this up in one of her groups, because she was inspired into this whole area when an Australian bioartist 10 years ago, I think it was, made tiny, tiny little frog steaks from stem cells, like engineered them, and had, it was part of an art exhibit, and they had the frogs looking on while
they were
at their little steaks. I'm not sure if anyone ate them. I'm not sure I would have in 2004. So it kind of a bit creepy, but also a bit nice. And I thought part of it kind of takes you back to how farming was originally created. Communities grew up around farming regions, you know, where they were hubs for people. And this kind of feels like a idealistic version of lab meat.
Yeah, you didn't get many bioreactors in the olden days next to your
no.
farmed food.
No, absolutely not.
Also, I mean, you still have to come to terms with the fact that you are going to have to kill the animals and eat them. Whereas I quite like the idea.
Not lab meat.
No, in the olden days.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas I quite like the idea that this way you have like a lovely animal that is the sort of centre of your community, and you can look upon it fondly and know that it's
giving you nutrition without even knowing it. I quite like it. And obviously the whole point is moving away from kind of mass production and huge factories where you don't know what's happening to your meat. But I mean, would both of you eat lab meat, first of all, now? Just someone slabbed some, like, some cells that have been nurtured on your plate.
Out of curiosity, yes. And I think if anyone already eats or has eaten, like, fish sticks or seafood sticks, whatever they're called, or most chicken nuggets or any processed meat, I don't think this is a huge leap from that. Like some of the stuff I've eaten is just so far removed from the animal that you think it's coming from.
They really gross me out, like crab sticks.
Yeah.
Like, what is
you
in that
read
stick?
The ingredients. It's what is surimi fish protein? I don't know. Or corn, you know, that's grown in cultures. That's, you know, grown in these big bioreactors.
Yeah. And I guess this is probably healthier and better for you. I mean, it's obviously it's manufactured, but it doesn't have anything kind of gross filler stuff.
Well, we don't know what it would need to have the texture, though. They might have to add... It depends on how they nail this.
Yeah. That's the thing. The technology is not quite there, right? You know, they can't develop complex different types of meat.
They might need to have like weird pate, like the insect pate we were talking about last year. So they have the protein cells and they have to kind of glue it together somehow. Ooh. Or they might develop the tissues, the connective tissues and
some kind of scaffolds that can be used as a replacement.
I mean, we've come to terms with the idea of actually eating animals. So perhaps we can also learn to get our head around these other concepts as well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like,
I'm sure.
Tofu and corn and other, you know, meat replacement products. I see this as probably more along those lines than actually creating a beautiful marbled T-bone steak that didn't actually involve killing an animal.
Oh, but then is anyone going to eat it?
Well, that's a very good question. Would you eat lab-grown meat if it didn't look like the cuts that you're used to? Tell us at podcast@wired.co.uk. So we finished our second segment and we are about to go into the feedback loop. Now, we had an email from Chris Allies, who wrote to us in relation to our story last week about ISPs having to send out letters to naughty copyright infringers. And he said, first, thanks for producing my favourite podcast. And he said, just because someone will have something for free doesn't mean they will pay for it. Just this morning, I took a free sample of a drink from a promoter in the street. It doesn't mean I'd pay for it. It was pretty dire. It's the same with people and piracy. To me, losses from piracy are therefore very hard to quantify. Copyright law is meant to protect returns on capital-intensive industries. A film can cost tens of millions. It's not meant to protect a company from new and disruptive technology. It is time for rights holders to embrace the internet as a new revenue stream and stop trying to protect the old revenue streams that don't exist anymore. Rights holders should compete with the piracy experience. For example, with a little setup, anyone can remote start a download from their smartphone anywhere where they have an internet connection. And I ask where the competition is from rights holders. I should be able to think that I want to watch a film tonight, make a purchase on the web, and have the file downloaded to my PC by the time I get home. It's 2014, and although there's been some progress in music, DRM-free downloads and Spotify, video content is lagging behind. Yes, we have streaming. Where's the DRM-free store selling files? Chris. I entirely agree with you, and I would love to see rights holders create better experiences online. I still find it ridiculous that there are some programs that until recently there was just no legal source to download. I mean, Game of Thrones is the classic example, and surprise, surprise, Game of Thrones is the most pirated show in history. But yes, we urge the rights holders to do more.
A listener who wants to be known as DFR for privacy reasons, probably wouldn't enjoy the post-privacy society idea, says, I have never written to a podcast before until your discussion on ISPs sending letters to pirates made me want to. I am a member of 5 private torrent trackers. My father taught me how to download from the internet when I was 13. I'm now 18 and pirating has remained a huge part of my life. I have always used a rather well-known British ISP for their fibre optic package to leech seed files, and not once have I received any warning, letter, threat. Absolutely zilch. I download and upload over 200 gigabytes a month sometimes, and honestly can't see them stepping in anytime soon with these letters. Maybe this is partly due to me being at uni and switching house every year or two, but when I lived with my parents, we all torrented for years, 10 plus, with no complaints. I personally believe if users are smart and use private sites or maybe a mixture of scratching the ISPs back by purchasing a higher end package, they can avoid major detection. Well, compared to, say, using the Pirate Bay, for instance.
Naughty, naughty DFR, but...
Yes, but I guess that, you know, it's good to hear from people like DFR, because there are probably lots of people that do this out there, and
yes,
the ISPs are clearly not getting through to them, and they don't seem afraid of the naughty letters.
I don't think the ISPs really care about the naughty letters either. I feel it's only the rights holders who are concerned about this. Yeah. But I'd be interested to hear if DFR does ever receive the naughty step letter, as I'm going to talk.
Or any of you.
2015, they're coming.
2015. Watch out.
So Lisa Neese wrote in about eating insects. We talked about something called the fly factory last week, which was kind of talking about how we could encourage people to eat more insects. She says, I think the discussion on eating bugs was really interesting, and in a weird way, I can see it going somewhere. I've never had a nibble on a bug myself, but when listening to the story, I remembered that when my family and I were travelling in Peru, at one point we actually ate some dirt. We were in a native village and some locals took us through their really common notion of eating some of their local soil on potatoes. Obviously, they knew exactly where to source a specific soil, but they've always incorporated it in their diets due to its high nutrient value. I think that this just goes to show that us Westerners are probably far too spoilt with our processed ready meals, and that there's nothing wrong with literally getting down and dirty with a bit of natural stuff in our diets. I couldn't agree more. A lot of the world does it. We are way behind. Tom Webb, who's a regular listener, wrote in about the same thing. He said, I went to a natural history museum once where I ate chocolate-coated crickets, and I must say they were amazing, just like eating toffee.
That makes me feel a lot more positive about eating insects, actually.
There's probably a lot of chocolate on them, not much cricket.
Well, Tom also talked to us a bit about the right to be forgotten. And he said, regarding your right to be forgotten, I also think that this should apply for certain aspects of life. Let's say at 18 years of age, you've committed a crime, and this can be as little as getting into a fight on a night out, and you end up with a criminal offence. Is this right that this little incident has affected him in applying for certain jobs due to his criminal record? Would it be fair to say that after a period of time, he could have the right to be forgotten? Yes, I mean, that's something we did actually discuss last week, was if minors, I mean, 18, I'm not quite so sure. I think you're a responsible adult by that point, but definitely if you're under 18, I think it's important that people should have the right to be forgotten.
I agree.
So that's all we have time for this week. If you do have any feedback from anything we've talked about this week or in any of the last episodes, do let us know. It's podcast@wired.co.uk, and you too may feature in the feedback loop. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.